normal course of events because you would get fouled out with the next hangar coming out. But one of them had burnt down and went in a fire, so that gave enough clearance. And it happened to be adjacent to the last hangar in the line, in the hangar line. So there was no obstruction getting into that last hangar. And then there was enough clearance to get out of it and get up before you ran into the ensuing hangars by virtue of the fact that one had been burnt down and left that clear. So that gives you some idea of the size of them. They were wooden trusses. They used very good wood, which has stood the test of time. They were tar paper covered, so you can imagine what sort of a fire hazard they were. Tar paper covered, wooden structure. Wooden planking on the walls covered with tar paper. And you know, of that original 18, and that figure is right, and I think it's not far from correct. There's still a number of those in existence and in use in the present day. There are. There are quite a number of them. They've been used for, they haven't been, in latter years, they've been converted to instructional purposes in the main. You get technical training schools and other types of schools using them. But there's very little flying. Camborden in recent years hasn't had very much flying. It did for World War II and for a few years thereafter, but then it became good and almost entirely to technical training. Now, in addition to those hangars, there are one or two technically oriented buildings, workshops, motor transport sections, supply and spare parts buildings, which are called storage buildings, equipment buildings. And the station headquarters, one or two other buildings of that nature. Those are all down in the hangar area, adjacent to the hangar line. And then removed from that by about 300 yards or four, maybe 400 yards, there was a living area where you had the quarters and the messes and so on. Always the troops marched to the hangar line from that living area. And there was always a bugle band up there. In the early morning hours, they would form up and they would parade down to the flights and break off. A flight troops would break off at A flight and B flight and B flight and C flight and C flight and so on. And the bugle band would lead them down. And the bugle band would lead them back at noonday for the recreation and luncheon hour. And the bugle band would take them back in the afternoon and return them in the evening. So when one thinks of Camp Borden, and I think Camp Borden, I can hear that bugle band playing away. And it was a good drum and bugle band. Maybe
inspire you to
15 or 20.
Did it give you any inspiration? Or?
And when we officers walked down there, we didn't very often drive to work. I don't think it was encouraged. You were expected to walk back and forth if you were a junior officer.
Junior officer.
So you would be strutting along with your cane flying to this. You wouldn't be part of the parade, but you could still perhaps be moving close enough that you could hear the music, and it made walking a little bit easier to do it to me. And I can remember there was a standing order. There were lots of peculiar standing orders. This wasn't peculiar. I guess it was fairly reasonable. But no motor car was permitted to pass the bugle band and the parade. The bugle band was leading these troops, and they were marching at 120 paces per minute. That was a bit slow for motor cars. But no motor car was to pass that parade. They'd have to dawdle along behind until they got down to the hangar line. So, and that was very strictly adhered to. The roads, of course, were a bit narrow. They were paved. They put in hard surface roads in World War I, but they didn't make them very wide. For a motor car to pass the troops on parade would have meant the car would have been very close to the parade, and therefore there was a danger of hitting somebody. That was the reason for it. And if anybody transgressed that regulation, they was hell to pay. enthusiastic young fellow might think he can get away with it, but you're in trouble if you broke that regulation.
Mm. What about
Now, yeah, I haven't finished there.
Oh,
down there, and we're. I told you there was the accommodation area, living accommodation. Well, there were a few berry blocks that had been constructed during World War I, I suppose to. There were times of the year when tents were a little bit unsuitable, and I think when RFC Canada started building there, they went away from the tent-type accommodation and built wooden structures, again tar papered. Mm-hmm. They weren't handsome at all, but they were adequate. And there were barrack blocks in there, and there were for the troops, mm-hmm. and there were quarters for the officers. Same type of wooden and tar paper covered, but with individual rooms for the officers. And then there was the mess. Had been constructed as such. Quite an attractive looking building, if you can think of a tar paper building as being attractive.
Right. Yeah.
But it was a lower type of structure than these others. These others were two stories with semi-steep roof. But the mess was sort of one-story building, and it had shrubbery trees around, so it wasn't hard on the eye. And it was attractive inside. It was well well fitted up inside. But unfortunately, the environment, the structure itself, was very dry, timbers and so on, and the climate was extremely dry at Camp Borden. And the grass around the place would get awfully burnt and dry, so the fire hazard was great. And also, there were lots of parties in the mess. And parties sometimes lend themselves to fire hazards. For example, upholstered furniture, cigarette rolls down in behind, and just before the mess was being cleared for the night, and nobody mm-hmm. notices that, and in due course, Chesterfield may catch a fire in a way. But several of those very nice officers' messes were lost with all the ornaments. And they were nicely ornamented. They had
they had
paintings from some of them oil paintings, others prints from World War I on the walls. There were this will break your heart, there were swords from various periods crossed above these mm-hmm. paintings, and there were models. Aircraft hanging from the rafters, and it was sort of a vaulted roof in the mess. And every time you had a fire, you lost all that, and your silver and whatnot. So that was those were sad. I think there were at least two messes burnt.
Now, would these be considered squadron messes or just a general Air Force mess?
These weren't squadron messes. This was a general Air Force mess. I suppose you could think of it as a squadron mess in the sense that there was a training, flying training squadron. Camp Borden was really, when it was reorganized, was called a flying training squadron. But the initial organization was a station organization. It was RCF Station Camp Borden, and it was a station mess rather than a squadron mess. I think back in the days of RFC and later RAF Canada, training establishment there, there probably were squadron messes. You know, there were two or three different training squadrons at Borden. And maybe the reason we had several successive station messes that we could burn down one after the other was because there had been a number of squadron messes, so we were just going from one to the other.
Now, was there much interchange between, say, the Army, Corps Signals, I imagine, would have their own mess. And
they had their own mess.
Would there be much exchange?
And their facilities were very similar as far as living accommodation to ours. There were, they had quite an attractive mess. And there was a lot of interchange between Signals and Air Force. We worked together. we worked, we were sort of component, two parts of one whole, and that as time went on, they were providing the signals, wireless and radio equipment, and technicians for us, not only to help us in our aircraft, but also as we branched out into flying in all northern reaches of Canada, as well as some of the southern reaches, they put in the signals stations, the sole purpose of which was to work with the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very, very close. General Finn Clark, who lives in this building, it was one of the young signal officers, Camp Borden, he came along. I don't think we're very far apart in age, but for one reason or other, he didn't join the Signal Corps until about 6 or 7 years, 5 or 6 years anyway, after I joined the Air Force. I think I was a flight lieutenant when he joined the Signal Corps. We used to play badminton together. He was a damn good badminton player. So there was a lot of interchange on the sports level. There was interchange in the social level, and we had certain Signal Corps officers and spent most of their time in our mess, and then a few that did both works, you know, and there were a few really good bridge players in the Signal Corps mess that preferred the Air Force mess because I think they thought they could make more money up there. Like Slim Macklin, I'm sure you've heard of, General Macklin. He was a lieutenant when I first knew him, and he became a captain. And he was an extremely intelligent man, erratic, unorthodox individual, very, very able bridge player and a very able officer. He and he later became the not the quartermaster general, the adjutant general, adjutant general, and Murchie. Murchie was forever in our mess. I don't think Murchie was a signals officer now that I come to think of it. I think Murchie was an infantry officer or artillery, I think infantry, who was seconded to Camp Borden for liaison duties. So if that were so, he were liaison with the Air Force, then naturally he'd be in our mess all day. He was a good bridge player. He became the Chief General Staff and was Chief General Staff during the war years. Bunny Weeks is another one. Bunny was in our mess very frequently. Captain Weeks in those days, when I was there in 28. He became, I guess Bunny was the Chief General Staff. I'm not sure about that. But at any rate, he was on the Army Council as well. He was a signaler. And we had two or three boys from Victoria there. But Judge McIntosh's sons are both in the Signal Corps. He was a judge here in Victoria. Had three daughters and two sons. The three daughters married into the services, two into the Navy, one into the Army, and the two boys went into Signal Corps. And
what about costs and things? I got two questions. In comparison, say, like to the Navy, the young fellows are called snotties, you know, things like that. Were you given any derogatory names, number one, and number two?
Yeah.
I'll start with that one first. Any derogatory names for you?
I think the most common name, and this came from we had an awful lot of Englishmen there who came over after World War. Had been both in the RFC and the RNAS and the RAF. They came over and joined up, and they were part of the non-permanent Air Force, not the permanent Air Force. And I don't know what percentage of Englishmen there would be, but there were some small percentage of Englishmen, the rest were Canadians. The English, I think, generally referred to us as bog rats. Bog rat was the derogatory term that was given to a young officer. And I can't think of it. There must have been other terms, too, but that's the one that comes to my mind. Bog rat.
What about pay now? You had worked as an engineer.
Yeah.
Now, how would your pay as a pilot officer compare? repair? I mean...
Well, an engineer in those days didn't get very much money. I think I thought I was pretty well paid as an engineer, but I had worked one or two summer holidays while I was at Acadia University. It was before I got involved in these summer survey camps. In those days, I was getting 25 cents an hour for hard labor, construction, heavy construction work. And so when I went up to, after I graduated and went up to work with Hamilton, with the Canadian Westinghouse Company, we were getting, I guess we must be getting all of 50 cents an hour. And that seemed a great boost in status. And then we were so busy on that big transmission line job that there was a lot of overtime work, so we got time and a half for overtime. No such thing as double time. We work on the weekends and get time and a half. So it was a 10-hour day. You know, everybody worked 10 hours in those days. 7 in the morning till 5 in the evening. We were earning $5 a day, that's pretty good pay. I don't think we got quite that because they took time off for the lunch now. So we got a little bit less than $5 a day. And then there'd be the overtime would add to that. You worked also on Saturday morning. That was a regular working time for those days. So overtime started any time after noonday, Saturday, or after 5 o'clock in the afternoon on weekdays. So that gives you some idea of the amount of income. It wasn't great, but it was adequate, and we were living sort of in the lap of luxury. But then when we got to the Air Force, that was the salaries then weren't all that great, but the pilot officer, I think, was getting a little over $200 a month, maybe around $225 a month. You had greater expenses, but there seemed to be enough money left over. Everybody lived pretty reasonably. You had expenses in the mess, and you had expenses for uniforms. But almost every one of the young officers there in my time had enough left over to buy a motor car, albeit on time. Mm-hmm. I bought a Model T Ford. Generally, you bought a used car. The Model A Ford had just come into being in 1927, I think. I bought a Model T in fall of 1928, which was about 4 years of age. At that time, it was a kind of good car. I really couldn't afford it, but it was sort of the thing to do. You were isolated at Camp Borden. You didn't have a car. You were marooned. You couldn't get down to Toronto very readily. You couldn't get over to the beaches. There was Mississauga Beach, which was a great place to go, and there were Berry's Bay and all sorts of places to go, and Shanty Bay, where people had summer cottages, and if you had a car, you could get there and participate in social life at these resorts. So, even though one couldn't afford it, one generally picked up a motor vehicle. So that's why. Some who didn't earn it, capable of managing their money, did get into considerable debt at salaries of that type. We had a French-Canadian by the name of Jean Bonnard, very, very likable lad. He was born up on the eastern shores of the Hudson's Bay, the son of a fur trading factor up there. Was sent as a young man over to France to be educated, did his schooling there, and went into the French Air Force as a corporal pilot. And a corporal pilot in those days, I suppose, would make the equivalent of about 35 cents a day or less. I don't imagine more. I think the salary for the week came to in our money to $2 or $3. So when this young lad transferred, came back to Canada and joined the Air Force, he wasn't in the regular force, he was in the non-permanent active Air Force. He had no money sense whatsoever, but his $225, whatever, if that was the sum, was gone in a flash, and at the end of the month he was in debt. We had to bail him out many times. But he was not knowing the value of money, and that's not probably the right way to put it, not having had any experience in handling money or banking money. He didn't know what a bank was for. We took him down and introduced him to the banker and got him the bank account, and he thought that was great. All he had to do was write checks and buy anything. So he would go out in the evening and find himself an attractive girl and fall in love with her and go and buy a wristwatch the next day. So you can see $225 wasn't enough money for everybody, but it was quite adequate for those who knew how to handle them themselves.
What about the mess itself, the messing facilities? Now, would you eat in the officer's mess every day?
Oh, yes.
Morning,
evening,
dinner?
That's right. Breakfast, noon, and night.
And then there'd be recovery.
And I should also say there was afternoon tea. And that was the influence. All of the Canadians who had served in the RSC and the RNAS and the RAF had become accustomed to afternoon tea because they were serving in British formations. And these two British officers had come over and joined the non-permanent active Air Force and the RCAF. They were accustomed to their tea. So there were not only the three meals and the mess, but tea was set up in the afternoon at 4:30. You came back from the flight lines and went to tea. And there was a great table with these heavy Air Force cups, and there were cakes and cookies, and if anybody wanted sandwiches, I guess they had those there too. But this was just a little interlude before dinner came on a little bit later.
Would there be a bar as well?
Oh yeah.
Of course.
Oh yeah. Yes. Generally, extensively on the weekends. There were too many who abused themselves in the weekdays, although with a cross-section like that, you're bound to get a few who drank too much during the week. But it wasn't regarded as quite the thing to do. It didn't go too well with flying to drink a lot during the weekdays, but those who held themselves back during the weekdays made up for it the weekend. So Monday morning was always a difficult time in flight life.
I'm thinking, Air Marshal, that I should put this, the cost, like, you would be subsidizing the ration then? Is that how it would work, that you would be paying, like, your mess dues would be covering because of all this extra service and
yeah.
food?
Yeah, there was a certain amount of food provided on rations from the ration store. And then that was supplemented by generally the messing officer and the assistant messing officer working under the guidance of the chef who would make additional purchases. Everybody had auxiliary functions in those days. You were either a bar officer, an assistant bar officer, a messing officer, a mess secretary. And you had to do with these extra purchases you referred to, you had to do with keeping the accounts of the mess. You didn't have an accountant. One of the officers was designated to do this.
Junior officer, I imagine.
They were accountant officers on the station looking after the main station account. And no doubt they were supervisors of the activities of these junior officers. But that was a very responsible position which was taken seriously. And the mess accounts were made up. Well, there was a mess corporal, I think, who did a lot of the spade work of writing things up, but at least the supervision was all underneath junior officers.
And I gather then you would be charged mess dues, and then for all your alcohol and other cigarettes
that
you would pay, this would be chitted on.
Yes, that's it. And you could put all sorts of things on your mess account. The only gambling that was permitted in the mess, the bridge, you weren't allowed to play poker, things like that. And that's not to say that sometime or other there wouldn't be some, but you couldn't put anything but bridge debts in the mess book. And there was a bridge book maintained. And at the end of the bridge game, the debts were, the winnings and the losses were recorded. And then the accountant officer, at the end of the month, took the bridge book along with all the other expenses and either gave you a credit or gave you a charge, depending on how successful you'd been in your bridge during the month.
Well, so the bridge was a very social, integral part of
it. Oh, it was. It was in the heyday of bridge. And
what kind of money
it was at
for
the tail end of auction bridge and just near the start of the contract.
What kind of money would be...
it was never very high. I think a tenth of a point was fairly common. I think the station commander would frown on anything very excessive. He'd lay down.
Yes.
I don't think it was laid down in regulations any place, but if he thought the stakes were getting too high.
It was regulations, I'm thinking as well, what if someone was, I guess, hitting the bottom a little hard? I guess the station commander would... The mess bills would be looked over to make sure the young, second Louis wasn't knocking them back every day.
Absolutely. And the mess secretary and the mess president kept an eye on things like that, too. And they kept a general eye on how the officers conducted themselves in normal mess life and at mess dinners and so on. Mess dinners are always a good place to determine whether somebody was drinking to excess, because you had a good opportunity to observe there, both at the formal table and at the activities after the dinner.
A mess dinner would go you'd have one a week anyway, I guess, is that correct?
Yeah.
You would have to dress for dinner?
Oh, yes, yeah. In fact, you had to dress fairly often for dinner. There's what they called dining in nights were fairly frequent. I can't remember precisely how frequently they were, but on dining in nights you wore a mess undress, whereas in guest nights you wore a mess dress.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference being that instead of having the gold blade down the side of your trouser, you were wearing your blue stripe down the side. And instead of wearing the white vest with your mess jacket, you wore the blue, waistcoat. So that's about the only difference.
Well, I think we've got a hell of a start, to say the least, today. And, sir, if I can, come and see you again, we could pick up on training. I think we've got a really good description of, 1928 RCAF.
Yeah. The only thing that we didn't get into there, which you might be interested in, or maybe it's not necessary, was a description of the aircraft.
Well, if you're
training aircraft,
training and into the aircraft, the actual equipment used,
Yeah.
those types of things, I figured we'd go into that. Thank you very much, Air Marshal.
Okay.